Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Susanna Patton and I'm a research fellow and project director in the Power and Diplomacy Program. Today I'm joined by Charmaine Willoughby, an Associate Professor of International Studies at De La Salle University in Manila, to discuss the foreign policy implications of the recent Philippine presidential election. According to unofficial results, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has won a landslide victory in the Philippine presidential election held on 9 May. According to results tallied so far, Marcos has won more than 30 million votes, which represents about 60% of the electorate. This is more than double the amount of votes won by his main rival, current Vice President Lenny Robredo. Marcos is a polarizing figure, both domestically and internationally, and he has sought to rehabilitate the regime of his father, dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who was ousted in the 1986 People Power Revolution. Over the more than 20-year period preceding his ousting, the name Marcos became synonymous around the world with authoritarianism and kleptocratic rule. The return of the Marcos dynasty to the presidential palace has caused anxieties and questions both in the Philippines and abroad about the future of Philippine democracy, as well as about the foreign policy trajectory of a key US ally in Southeast Asia. Charmaine, you argued last year in a paper that normally bread-and-butter economic issues dominate elections in the Philippines, but that the two candidates needed to articulate some clearer positions on foreign policy. In the end, can you tell me how did foreign policy issues play out in the election campaign?
Hi, Susanna. Thanks for inviting me to this podcast. It's a good opportunity a week after the elections to talk about what happened in the Philippines and what the future might bring in regard to foreign policy and the country's international relations. In general, foreign policy has never really been an election issue, and that has not been, you know, there's not been much of a surprise in this election cycle, because what really dominated the campaigns were, as you said, bread and butter issues, not necessarily, you know, sovereignty, territorial claims in the South China Sea, for instance. But I continue to argue that even though foreign policy has never been an election issue and we've not really heard the candidates and the presumptive president say anything much about foreign policy, I still argue that, and I still believe that foreign policy should be part of the conversation. If anything, because the last 6 years have shown us the risks of setting aside foreign policy concerns. And here I speak about the Duterte administration's pivot to China. Early in President Duterte's administration, when he visited Beijing in October 2016, a couple of months after he came to office, he immediately announced his separation from the United States and his pivot to China. There were some benefits for the Philippines with this pivot, one of which is that it definitively lowered the tensions in the South China Sea. This came at the heels of the 2016 arbitration award in favor of the Philippines. So tensions were really high at that time. But the fact that President Duterte, you know, did an about turn and said, I am now reinvigorating the Philippines' bilateral relations with China, to a certain extent, that was really a good move because it lowered the tensions in the contested waters. But there were also other things that justify or explain that policy. One of which is that, you know, President Duterte came to power on a platform of anti-drugs and ridding the country of criminality. So immediately when he came to power, he immediately launched his now infamous war on drugs. So he needed, and after all the reports and the criticisms from the West, from the United States and European countries, President Duterte needed support for his war on drugs. And China was more than happy to provide that support. There were also criticisms about a potential ICC case regarding human rights violations and crimes against humanity. So President Duterte really need an alternative backer, a source of support for his domestic policies. But another benefit for the Philippines regarding this pivot to China is that President Duterte also received support from China for his flagship Build, Build, Build program. This is his infrastructure program, which unfortunately 6 years down the road, we do not really see, the Build, Build, Build program, in other words, did not really bear much fruit. So the point that I'm trying to make is that foreign policy has never really been an election issue, but it should, precisely because, you know, if we keep on shoving this issue under the rug, there are so many things that eventually affect and impact the Philippines. Even though there were some benefits that we were able to gain from it, it's more important. It's even now actually more critical to pay more attention to foreign policy. The election of Bongbong Marcos into the presidency also demonstrates the vast machinery that the campaign relied on. And here I'm speaking about information campaigns and influence operations that really found fertile ground in social media networks like Facebook and TikTok and Twitter and YouTube. There have been a lot of studies about information campaigns, trolling camps, and so on. And we're also seeing the beginnings of these information campaigns morphing into influence operations. So it's not so much now just about character assassinations of people, but it's also conditioning the way that we perceive reality. So These types of activities really contribute to eroding democracy in the Philippines. So again, yes, in short, if we don't pay attention to foreign policy, there's going to be a lot of things that are brewing and it would just spill over later on and it will become a problem later on. So foreign policy should continue to be part of the conversation.
I think that's a really great overview of the Duterte administration's foreign policy that you gave, Charmaine. And I really like your point about the intersections between domestic and foreign policy, because the Duterte administration shows, I think, that those human rights issues can really inform the choices that that the Philippines is constrained with in terms of the major powers. And of course, more generally, it strikes me that the election of Bongbong Marcos is part of a regional trend that we're seeing of kind of hybrid authoritarian and democratic rulers who have some sort of element that is authoritarian, but also some kind of democratic backing, which can be very challenging, especially for the United States to deal with, which I guess leads me to my next question, which is how you think that the Marcos Jr. government would deal with the alliance with the United States. Do you think there would be continuity there with the turbulence of the Duterte administration, or can we expect something different?
That's a good word of describing the foreign policy or the relationship of the Philippines with the United States. President Duterte really started his administration with his very anti-US stance, and that therefore was the root of the policy oscillation of the Philippines. It's a love-hate relationship between President Duterte and the United States. If you recall, there were talks about abrogating the Visiting Forces Agreement and then suspending the abrogation before eventually canceling the abrogation. So in essence, the alliance is back on track despite all the drama that happened in between. So in that sense, given that background, the Marcos presidency What we need to understand about the Marcos presidency is that this is really a restoration of the Marcos family name. And the Marcos campaign really, really portrayed that Marcos, the father's reign or rule in the country, these were the glory days of the Philippines, despite the fact that martial law was imposed and despite all the reported human rights violations. The campaign was really able to turn the narrative around and portray this as the glory days of the country. So in essence, the incoming Marcos presidency really is about restoring the family name and the image of the Marcoses in the Philippines and around the world. That being said, With that background, then we can expect at least something very different with the alliance with the United States, given this narrative on which the new Marcos presidency stands. What complicates matters, though, is that he has pending cases in the United States, so he can't really go to the United States for meetings and whatnot. But this is not really a surprise for the Philippines, because Duterte also did not step into American soil all throughout his presidency. He was absent in the recent U.S.-ASEAN summit, for instance. But then again, there is hope for a positive relationship between the two countries, considering that President Biden also gave a call to Marcos to congratulate him for his win in the elections. The thing about the U.S.-Philippine alliance, though, is that administrations, presidents come and go, but the alliance itself remains. And this is largely due to the success of the institutional linkages, professional networks, and personal networks that have characterized the alliance since the very beginning. So annual exercises, Balikatan exercises, proceed as usual, and this demonstrates alliance resilience. This is not to say, though, that there's nothing wrong with the alliance, that everything is rosy and perfect in the alliance. Alliance management is something that the two countries should really confront head on so that they can confront current and contemporary issues.
Do you think there will be enough stability for some of the kind of step ups in the alliance that have been discussed in the past? Like, I think the enhanced defense cooperation agreement between the US and the Philippines, given the uncertainty about what was going to happen with the VFA under the Duterte administration, I'm not sure that we really saw much progress there. Do you think that could change in the next 6 years?
Well, if we're simply talking about motivation, I think there's motivation on both sides. But this motivation has to be propped up by continuing modernization efforts on the part of the Philippines. You know, before we can even deepen our alliance with the United States, we really need to hasten and to move up to the next stages of the modernization program, without which I think we will just be, you know, as dependent on our partners and ally in regard to, you know, military issues.
You mentioned the deep institutional linkages between the United States and the Philippines, especially in the security sector. One of the constraints that many analysts pointed to in the Duterte administration was the fact that the Secretary of Defense and maybe to a lesser extent Foreign Affairs were moderating influences in terms of the alliance and advocated against the abrogation of the VFA, for example. Do we know much about what key people Marcos Jr. will have around him during his next 6 years?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. We are all still waiting for official announcements in regard to cabinet positions. There have been some names that have been floated around. There have also been some official announcements. So, for instance, Vice President Sara Duterte, who initially said that she wanted to become the next Secretary of National Defense, was appointed the Secretary of Education instead. But apart from that, I think we still need to wait until a couple of weeks before June 30, which is the official inauguration of the new administration.
Okay, we'll have to wait and see on that one. Turning to the Philippines, other sort of key major power relationship, and that's the relationship with China. You touched on this earlier, Charmaine, that early in Duterte's administration, he made a big effort to try and attract Chinese investment into infrastructure to support his build, build, build agenda. But later it seemed like he became a little disillusioned and there was a perception that China hadn't followed through and that the Philippines swung back its position a little bit. What approach do you think Marcos would be likely to take towards China? I've seen a couple of schools of thought on this floating around, one which points to his close connections with China through his family, and another which says, well, there was a failure to deliver by China, and so the Philippines is more alive to the risks of partnering with China than it was 6 years ago, say.
Yeah, the thing with the Marcos administration is that during the campaign, there was really no clear platform other than the, you know, very generic unity theme. And unity by itself is good, but, you know, now is the time to convert those campaign promises into policy. So we can't really gauge right now as to how those campaign promises or directions or lack thereof would translate into policy. But this much we know. Marcos announced that he would be pretty much continuing President Duterte's policy. And shortly after he announced his candidacy in October 2021, he also met with the Chinese ambassador to the Philippines. So that gives us an indication of how close his relationship with China is. And you're absolutely right that he should be a little bit more cautious about reinvigorating or deepening relations with China, considering that the relationship did not really bear much fruit in the Duterte administration. China also gained some benefit, actually, from Duterte's pivot to China policy in the last 6 years, particularly in the downplaying of the 2016 arbitration award. And also by the fact that the Philippines was able to marginalize discussions on the South China Sea when the Philippines was chair of the ASEAN in 2017. Not only that, there were a couple of maritime incidents involving the Chinese militia and Filipino fisher folks that were understated, and there were instances where the patrols and presence of the armed forces of the Philippines and the Philippine Coast Guard were limited because of the presence of Chinese ships in the contested waters. But apart from that, on the ground, there's really very strong anti-China sentiment for Filipinos. In surveys done by the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore, for instance, or in local studies that I myself have been involved in, where we looked at perceptions of the strategic community and Filipinos in general, surveys reveal that Filipinos really still prefer the traditional partners like the United States, Australia, Japan, and partnering with China is way down in the priority list. So this tells us really that there is still very strong anti-China sentiment in the Philippines. The pandemic did not help China's soft power at all. Particularly in regard to how President Duterte really was inclined only towards China in his pandemic response. When the vaccines were first rolled out in the Philippines, a lot of Filipinos did not have a choice as to which vaccine that they could get. Sinovac was the only choice for a lot of Filipinos. It was only later that other brands of vaccines came in, and it was only later when Filipinos had a choice as to which vaccine that they could get. But the earlier tranches of vaccine rollout, it was just really Sinovac. Apart from that, also in regard to pandemic response, the Philippines was the only country that was required to wear not just a mask, but also a face shield And that was very difficult to do, but it was a requirement for us when we're going out to, you know, the grocery store, for instance. And then later on, it was learned that we were only required to wear these face shields because the administration had contacts with Chinese companies that provide and that profited from the selling of these face shields. So ordinary Filipinos then were like, well, we don't really like China because of how the government responded to, you know, the pandemic and how everything can actually be rooted back to China. So this should serve as a warning to the incoming Marcos administration, considering how strong the anti-China sentiment is on the ground and considering that the benefits from the Duterte administration were really not forthcoming. So he really needs to balance his policy towards China and at the same time balance this with the alliance with the United States.
Those are really interesting points about the constraint that public opinion poses on foreign policy in the Philippines. Can I ask you, Charmaine, to elaborate a bit about the South China Sea? Because you touched on that already. And I believe that it's still the case that there are Chinese fishing vessels intruding into the Philippines EEZ. Do you see that public opinion about the South China Sea issue could become more inflamed again? Because my perception, looking at this from a distance, is that the South China Sea issue hasn't had the kind of level of heat in terms of the public discussion in the Philippines that it had under, say, the previous administration.
Right. This is something that's tragic in the Philippines. When we talk about the West Philippine Sea or the South China Sea, it doesn't really gain as much traction, and for good reason. You know, like, talks about or discussions about territorial integrity or sovereign integrity, these concepts don't really mean much to a lot of Filipinos when all they're really concerned about is living on a day-to-day basis. However, the South China Sea issue will become, you know, part of normal discourse or regular discourse on the ground if it is translated or reframed as, say, you know, a food security issue. When Filipinos realize that fish prices on the market are suddenly shooting up, then they would pay more attention to what's happening in the South China Sea, because that means, you know, access to our own fishing waters, access to our own resources, and so on.
This is maybe a too detailed a question, because as you've pointed out, we don't know too much about how the Marcos administration will deal with China. But in terms of the South China Sea, do you think that we could see a return to more multilateral channels for dealing with the problem with China rather than the bilateral track, which the Duterte administration appeared to favor?
This is the risk that we are, and the concern that we are facing now, because considering the close relationship between President Marcos and the Chinese embassy in the Philippines, there is the risk that bilateral negotiations would continue the way it did during the Marcos administration. But it really depends on the people that President Marcos would surround himself with, whether or not they would advise him to leverage multilateral platforms as opposed to just staying in the bilateral frameworks.
And I guess related to that is the question of what this election and its outcome mean for the future of ASEAN, not just in terms of the South China Sea, but more broadly. We've seen that since 2016 and the Philippines walking away from the arbitral decision, Vietnam has been quite out in front and quite on its own on the South China Sea issue, certainly. And more generally, I think there's a perception that across Southeast Asia, there's been limited pushback to China's growing regional influence. I'm just wondering how you see the trend for ASEAN over the next few years.
ASEAN by itself also has a lot of problems. But it's not something that we can just set aside and do away with. Centrality by itself also has a lot of shortcomings and a lot of loopholes. But at the same time, the Philippines is a founding member of ASEAN. So I think by virtue of that, the Philippines really still needs to reinvigorate its ties with its neighbors and also with the organization. Centrality, ASEAN centrality may mean different things for different people, for different countries. But the fact is, this is still the only organization that we have in the region. And while personally, I would argue that this centrality needs to evolve, to what it is evolving is still something that we don't know yet. There are minilateral arrangements that are emerging, but whether or not these minilateral arrangements can take the place of ASEAN is still something that everybody is still trying to grapple with.
Mm, that's right. And we're seeing the Quad Summit will be held in Tokyo next weekend. So we'll see what comes out of that. But but I think across Southeast Asia, there are still some ambivalence about the role of the Quad and how it will be positioned vis-a-vis ASEAN, not to mention the issue of AUKUS, where we saw actually some quite divergent views coming from the Duterte administration on AUKUS, I think.
Yeah, so these are some of the arrangements that have cropped up. And instead of the Philippines' default in the last 6 years to always just turn its back on these types of arrangements, I think for the new administration, for the Philippines in general, we should really know how to navigate these different arrangements and to leverage them so that we can advance our interests.
I think that's a really good point. And I suppose just one final question that I would have for you, Charmaine, is I'm here in Sydney where the Lowy Institute is based. What do you think people in Australia need to know about the Philippines, or what could Australia be doing effectively in the Philippines to advance the bilateral relationship? How should we prepare ourselves for the next 6 years?
Well, there are two things I think that are important to note. First, that information campaigns and influence operations should be part of our strategic horizons, that we should not just think that, oh, what happens in social media will stay in social media. Actually, what happens in social media can actually frame and influence and shape foreign policy and international relations, because this is about narratives and rhetoric and perceptions and how we interact and then eventually deal with each other. So let's not understate the impact of information campaigns. And second, Philippine-Australia relations have always been very good in terms of counterterrorism, cooperation. At the same time, it's been proven that our two countries really do well in terms of HADR, disaster response. So I think these efforts should continue, but at the same time, we need to be open to other types of security cooperation measures, particularly information campaigns.
I think that's a really good point and something that's going to be very important for the next Australian government to consider in its relationship with the Philippines and with the region more broadly. And as you might know, we have an election here as well coming up this weekend, so we'll see what comes of that. But thank you so much for your time, Charmaine. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Asana, and I hope to be able to join you in future conversations as well.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute, hosted by Institute experts and produced by Josh Godding. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode of Lowy Institute Conversations. Mm-hmm.